The attacks of 9/11 had dealt a serious blow to an economy that had been in a downturn and that we would soon learn had entered into a recession in March. According to the National Bureau of Economic Research, the official arbiter of business cycles. Assistance was needed to help stabilize the airline industry financially. We also pushed forward in Congress a new economic stimulus package to help displaced workers, sped up the tax cuts passed early in the year, and provided additional relief to moderate and low-income Americans. However, while the House passed the package quickly, the Democratic-led Senate refused to act. Final passage of a scaled-down economic stimulus package would not happen until the following year. Looking back on the post-9/11 period, however, I think that one event with an enormous impact on President Bush's mindset has been almost forgotten by many people: the anthrax attacks. One of the biggest concerns within the White House and intelligence community in the days and weeks after 9/11 was the possibility of a second wave of attacks. When word reached the White House on the morning of October 4th that a man in Florida had contracted a lethal dose of inhalation anthrax, those concerns were heightened. There were indications later that day the case might be isolated and not an act of terrorism, but the Centers for Disease Control and FBI quickly began investigating the matter. The following day, the Florida victim, Bob Stevens, died. Traces of anthrax were found at his office building in Boca Raton on Sunday, October 7th, leading officials to evacuate it and begin testing those who worked in the building. Earlier that same day, the president had addressed the nation to announce the beginning of Operation Enduring Freedom, the military campaign aimed at removing the Taliban regime from power and bringing to justice the Al-Qaeda terrorist in Afghanistan. The source of the anthrax that killed Bob Stevens remained uncertain. One of my new duties in the post-9/11 White House was helping Ari Fleischer to stay on top of this potential bioterrorist threat. I stayed in contact with my counterparts at the Department of Health and Human Services and began working closely with Lisa Gordon Haggerty, an exceptionally bright and tireless public servant who worked in the counterterrorism unit of the National Security Council under Richard Clark. Lisa was running point for the NSC on the anthrax attacks. Several days after Stevenson's death, letters containing anthrax began turning up in New York and Washington, including one sent to the offices of NBC News and Senate Majority Leader Tom Daschle. The letter to Daschle contained a particularly lethal strain of the bacterium, heightening fears in Washington and beyond. Reports of white powder that people feared was anthrax started to pop up all over. Most turned out to be false alarms, but the fear permeating the country was real, and it wasn't long before the press began asking whether the source of the anthrax could be a foreign government. The early indications we had been getting privately didn't appear to point overseas, but as Ari and the new Homeland Security Advisor Tom Ridge held their early briefings, nothing could be definitively ruled out. The anthrax situation continued to become more troubling. We were starting to wonder when it would stop. Two postal workers in a Northeast D.C. postal facility, Thomas L. Morris Jr. and Joseph P. Kersine, died later in October from inhalation anthrax. The White House remote mails facility tested positive for small traces of anthrax. For months to come, as I remember well, delivery of all White House mail was delayed for inspection and irradiation. Amid all the reports, mostly false, of possible anthrax cases, around 9 p.m. on the night of October 23rd, I received a call from Bill Pierce, a Department of Health and Human Services public affairs official, warning of a possible case of smallpox in the Orlando, Florida area. A man had showed up at a local hospital and was quarantined out of caution for exhibiting what medical personnel thought could be signs of the deadly disease. We could only imagine the panic it would cause if it turned out to be true. I alerted Ari to the story and waited anxiously for further word from Bill Pierce. I got it a short time later that evening. It was a false alarm. The man did not have smallpox, but syphilis. "Syphilis?" I asked Bill. "How could they confuse that with smallpox?" Bill didn't know, but we were both relieved. I went up to Ari's office right after that call. "Well, I've got good news for us. The man in Florida does not have smallpox, but there's bad news for him. He has syphilis." As Ari later recounted in his memoir, Taking Heat, he replied with a joyful shout, "Yes, it's syphilis. He's got syphilis." We all went home a little more relaxed that evening. But the source of the anthrax attacks remained uncertain. We received a private briefing a couple of days later about the anthrax in the letter to Daschle. Analysis revealed that it was from the same strain as the others, but more sophisticated. Thousands of FBI agents were now involved in the investigation into the 9/11 hijackings and the anthrax attacks. Pursuing any lead, interviewing friends and neighbors of those who'd come into contact with the anthrax, and seeking to determine its origin. I also remember Ari's frustration with an inaccurate ABC News report the evening of October 26th, another story he recounted in Taking Heat. Since no source could be officially ruled out, the media were pursuing all angles. Brian Ross, a highly respected investigative reporter for ABC News, led the newscast that night, stating that he had learned from three well-placed but separate sources that initial tests had found the chemical additive bentonite in the anthrax, and that the only country known to have used this substance to produce biological weapons was Iraq. Bentonite, Ross reported, was a trademark of Saddam Hussein's biological weapons program. Peter Jennings indicated that some would conclude this was a smoking gun linking the anthrax attacks to Iraq. ABC did mention that Ari had denied in the strongest terms that it was bentonite. But Jennings also talked about the raging argument in the administration about going after Saddam Hussein. Ari relentlessly pursued the story and continued to badger a variety of people at ABC to see if they were going to correct the story in the days after it aired. On October 31st, ABC backtracked from its previous report, saying only that a further chemical analysis had ruled out bentonite in the anthrax, although it did contain silica, which is not a trademark of any country's weapons program. They refused to offer a full retraction, however, which frustrated not only Ari, but all of us who were concerned with getting accurate information out to the public. Perhaps it was an early vivid signal of the national media focusing on a potential conflict with Iraq at the expense of important truths about the actual necessity for war. By early November, there had been 16 confirmed cases of anthrax exposure. A New York woman, Kathy Wynn, had died in late October. The FBI had determined that the NBC, Florida, and Daschle letters had all been sent from the same mailbox in Trenton, New Jersey, and agents were trying to track down who might have placed them there. Still, it could not be determined definitively whether the source was domestic or foreign. To this day, no one has been charged with the anthrax killings, though many law enforcement personnel believed that the source was domestic. One person of interest was mentioned publicly, though never indicted. The influence of the anthrax attacks on policymaking within the Bush White House shouldn't be underestimated. Soon afterward, Vice President Cheney, along with Health and Human Services Secretary Tommy Thompson, led efforts to push ahead on a smallpox vaccine program for all Americans, in hopes of minimizing the impact of a bio-attack using smallpox. While many potential first responders and hospital personnel, those who might first come into contact with a smallpox outbreak, were eventually vaccinated, the more ambitious plan never materialized. We also pressed ahead with funding for Project BioShield, aimed at developing vaccines and stockpiling them to protect Americans in the event of a bioterror attack. I know President Bush's thinking was deeply affected by the anthrax attacks. He was determined not to let another terrorist attack happen on his watch and to challenge regimes believed to be seeking weapons of mass destruction. While his strategies for pursuing those objectives would later be questioned, his concern was sincere. That Christmas, shortly after the anthrax stories had finally faded from the headlines, I flew home to Austin to spend time with my family. Upon boarding the airplane, I looked down at my seat and noticed what appeared to be a trail of white powder on the edge of the seat. I paused ever so briefly, shook my head, and thought to myself, "You've got to be kidding. Of all the seats, I picked the one with the white powder on it." I took a deep breath, brushed it aside, and sat down, glad to be going home to my family. Later, I wondered what would have happened if someone else had found the powder. Maybe the flight would have been delayed or canceled as the powder was tested and the plane swept for residue. Personally, I have a theory as to the source of this particular contamination. I think someone on the previous flight had been eating a donut, the kind with white powdered sugar on top. The unity in Washington during those first few months following the 9/11 attacks was a welcome change. The outpouring of unified sentiment was unlike any Washington had seen in decades. Would the politics as war mentality and the excesses of the permanent campaign era end as a positive side effect of an unprecedented national tragedy? It was not to be. The forces that had transformed Washington over three decades into a nexus of partisan warfare were far too powerful, and those forces were at work on both sides of the political divide. In January 2002, the first cracks appeared in the facade of bipartisan comity. During an open press Republican National Committee meeting in Austin, Texas, Karl Rove stated that the GOP would make the president's leadership in the war on terror the top issue for retaining control of the House and winning back the Senate in the midterms. Rove was the first administration official to publicly make the case for using the war as a partisan issue, a marked shift in tone from Bush's repeated emphasis on unity and bipartisanship in confronting and defeating radical Islamic terrorism. "We can go to the American people on this issue of winning the war," Rove said. "We can go to the country on this issue because they trust the Republican Party to do a better job of protecting and strengthening America's military might and thereby protecting America." At the time, polls showed the Republican Party with a sizable lead, 38 points in a Gallup survey, as the party Americans trusted most to deal with terrorism, and an even larger advantage on military and defense issues. While both parties would see the benefit of using such a sizable advantage on a major issue to their advantage in an election, Rove's candor about this strategy infuriated suspicious Democrats, who condemned Rove for trying to politicize the war. Soon, the president began campaigning openly again for Republican congressional candidates, including against incumbent Democratic members of Congress, touting his and GOP leaders' management of the war. As governor, he'd maintain good relations with friendly legislators by refusing to campaign against them, even if they were members of the opposing party. Bush's actions prompted concern and anxiety among Democrats. The brief period of bipartisan peace, initiated by 9/11, ended for good in May. The new round of warfare was set off by what seemed to be a startling revelation from CBS News. On its evening newscast of May 15, 2002, based on information it had received anonymously, CBS reported in dramatic fashion that the president had received an intelligence briefing in early August 2001 that specifically alerted him of a possible airliner attack in the United States. Correspondent David Martin went on to report, "The president's daily intelligence brief is delivered to the president each morning, often by the director of Central Intelligence himself. In the weeks before 9/11, it warned that an attack by Osama bin Laden could involve the hijacking of a U.S. aircraft." The report left much open to question. Was it suggesting that the president had received information that should have led him to act? Was it just a possible warning sign, like many others, that might have gone unheeded? Or was it something else? Possibly a nonspecific bit of intelligence from years earlier. These questions were unanswered at the time, but that mattered little to Democratic leaders in Congress. They saw an opportunity to attack the president's strong suit, his leadership in the war on terrorism, and cut into his enormous popularity ahead of the midterm elections that coming November.